Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Coming up on this week's program, we have a great show for you. We're going to be speaking to Egyptologist Dr. Bob Breyer, aka Mr. Mummy. He's going to be telling us the secrets of King Tut's tomb and what it was like to perform a mummification using ancient techniques himself. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us at @newstalkscience. You might be aware that I have made it my mission to raise AI literacy across the nation. If you'd like to learn how to use AI to help you as an assistant to become more creative, productive, and efficient, you can find out more at getstartedai.com. Now, it's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady from the DCU Insight Centre and science communicator Owen Murphy. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with a HIV breakthrough, Owen.
Yes, John. It's a sensational story, really, in the field of HIV cures. Coming out of the University of Melbourne and published recently in Nature Communications, what they found was that we know up to now we have treatments for HIV. Treatments, okay, not a cure. So up to now, they've had problems with actually getting the HIV virus to reveal itself out of the white blood cells. And this is over the decades now, we're fortunate enough they've got good treatments, okay, across the world.
Right, you can take a pill every day and have a very normal life with HIV, which is an incredible thing, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, a full, your life expectancy is the same as the general public. Some people take pills every day, some people take injections every 2 months. However, it's not a cure. There's currently about 40 million people in the world who are suffering from HIV. 95% of them are in the developing world. So it's skewed. It really is skewed. We still have one person a minute dying from HIV. Mm. Okay, so even though we've had great, great leaps and bounds made, there's this drive to get a cure. Can we finish? Can we go after it fully? So a group out of the University of Melbourne have been looking at ways of actually getting those HIV viral cells to present themselves. So maybe we can actually treat them. So what they did was they found up to now that you couldn't really get at them because they were hiding in the white blood cells. But they have come up with a way of using messenger RNA. Okay, so messenger RNA, the same messenger RNA which was used for COVID-19 vaccines, they've found a way to actually get them into those white blood cells. Now, what they've done is they've used lipid nanoparticles, short for LNP. Now, they can encapsulate the mRNA in it and they can send them in there. And what they can do is they can program these viral cells to present themselves on the outside of the white blood cells, opening up the possibility for treatments. I mean, it's a major breakthrough. Now, it must be noted that this was done on a cellular model. It hasn't got to animal models, hasn't got to human models, but the researchers themselves were absolutely gobsmacked by what they saw. It's to the point that they actually sent back the scientists, go and do the experiments again. No one has ever seen anything like this.
Yeah, this is obviously one of the things about HIV is that it is one of these viruses that is very tricky to get rid of because of how it integrates into our cells, and treatment, great, but actually finding a cure has been so elusive. In terms of the ability to actually remove the virus now that, as you say, it could be made visible to our immune system, which is the whole point of this, right? So if you get the virus visible on the white blood cells, you can actually use your natural immune system. How do they feel that that is a fairly easy step?
I mean, they do. They think so. Because you have this issue, like you said, of the reservoir of HIV being present there all the time. No matter how good the medication is, it's just not enough time to get rid of it or for your immune system to build up enough. So what they actually think now is that there's a real possibility here that by presenting on the outside, that they can target these HIV cells. And not only that, in this study, they actually found a way to encapsulate CRISPR gene editing mRNA into the same package with the idea that you can go after it and maybe genetically edit it as well.
Oh, right. I see. So not just, so using this sort of encapsulation method, like a little bubble that bursts when it needs to, a little fat bubble that bursts when you wanted to deliver like sort of reprogrammed DNA. The idea is that not only would you be able to see the virus, but you also might be able to snip it.
snip it, edit it, change it. And I mean, apart from even HIV, this has greater implications because there's other diseases, cancers that are affected, you know, they're linked to white blood cells. So if you can get to them, present them and send with it another arsenal of weapons really to actually change it, even before you get to medication, they might be able to look at treatments.
That's incredible. So really interesting to see where that research is going to take us over the next couple of years, but potential Nobel Prize winning stuff if it pans out to be something they can replicate, not just in the lab, but in patient cohorts. Shelley, our second story has to do with rhinos and literally cutting off the nose to spite your face.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a sad one, Jonathan. So the rhino is one of nature's most recognizable and majestic creatures, and their horn, which is, I suppose, kind of a symbol of their strength, has become one of its greatest vulnerabilities. We all know about the illegal trade of the rhino horn, and it's a huge threat towards the world's five rhino species. In particular, the poaching pressure is driving a rapid decline of Africa's black and white rhinos over the past decade. And you might wonder, how is this still happening in this day and age? Especially, we're also aware of huge conservation efforts, but it's the expense of protecting these rhinos. It's absolutely immense. So between 2017 and 2023, there were $74 million spent on anti-poaching measures. They've been hunted and killed for their horns for years. And this is, of course, driven by the black market demand. So now scientists and conservationists are turning to dehorning. So literally taking the horn away before the poachers can, and hopefully removing that incentive to poach the rhino directly.
I don't know how I feel about this. Is there evidence to suggest that that is in any way harmful to rhinos? I mean, it's pretty much a fairly defining feature of a rhino, its horn.
Sure.
To remove the horn preemptively seems very extreme.
It does. Now, they have done research and it's shown that the impact on the rhino's natural behaviours, it's shown no adverse effects on their breeding or their mortality rates. But the fact of the matter is, they use their horns for all sorts of things in the wild. So it's not just for show. They use it to defend themselves, to assert dominance, even to dig for water, break branches for food. So, but I suppose at the same time, what they've shown in this piece of research is across the 11 game reserves around South Africa's Kruger National Park, which is home to about a quarter of the world's rhino population, once the dehorning intervention was implemented, they found this led to about 3/4 less poaching. And then for each rhino that had been dehorned, the likelihood of them being poached within the year decreased by 95%. But at the other side of it is, yes, it's a tactic, but it's not perfect or permanent. So 111 dehorned rhinos were still poached because some of the horn is left behind.
111?
Yeah, and cut horns.
111 rhino?
Yeah.
When?
So that was between when this intervention has been put in place, so since 2023.
Oh my God, so you're saying 111 rhino were still killed despite the fact that they had their horn removed in the last 2 years?
Yeah, so there's some of the horn left behind, and the cut horns can also regrow. So it's a quick, kind of temporary, cost-effective method of curbing rhino poaching, but it's not a complete deterrent in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, obviously, the ones who should be punished here are those who are buying and trafficking this. It seems horribly unfair to be punishing the rhino for for the activity of some very self-interested humans. But like, do we know anything? And this probably wasn't in the story, but like, how are we policing the use and distribution of this in places like China, where they pay, you know, $3 a gram? But when you think about $3 a gram, it just seems like so little to get. But you know, 2019, about five, six years ago, there was a Vietnamese seizure of 125 kilos of smuggled rhino horns worth $7.5 million. So it's a lot of money, particularly if you're living in South Africa, where, you know, the rand is very poor and so on. Like, it is obviously a very lucrative thing, but I just had no idea we were talking about poaching of that scale still continuing.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly it. The poachers are hugely motivated. And the other side of it is that, yes, this particular intervention is showing to decrease the poaching behavior. There are other poaching prevention things in place, such as, you know, dogs, people that are supposed to be watching the area. But if you have enough money and you know the right people, these things are all circumnavigated. They can circumnavigate these. So I suppose that's another reason why this particular intervention is showing more success than other interventions.
Our third piece has to do with dinosaurs, Owen.
Yeah, I'm going to try and cheer things up because that was a tough one, okay?
Yeah.
So, Jonathan, please. I don't know about you, but I watched a lot of dinosaur programs in my house. But I often find myself watching this thinking, this is amazing watching this, but how do they really know this is what it was like? How do they know the forest looked like this? How do they know all of this happened? And this is a piece of research that's come out of a group of universities based in North Arizona, over to Aarhus in Denmark, and even Oxford, where they've actually taken a rich database of decades of work, really, and put it into a mathematical model. And what they're looking at is that they've tracked the size of dinosaurs and the mammals which follow them after extinction, and seed sizes. So there has generally been this consensus that bigger seeds means better for the plant that grows, because they can last longer, they can withstand drought conditions, tougher, harsh conditions. However, not everyone's been happy with that. And by going through these models and previous research, what they've found is that as the animals got bigger and bigger, so did the seeds and the fruit which they surrounded, up to a point. At that point, they see that the actual seeds begin to reduce in size. Now, what they believe has happened is that the size of the animals has actually engineered the environment, that the dinosaurs have got so big that by trampling through forests, they have actually changed the density of the grass, the vegetation there, and it's changed what it means to have an advantage as a seed. So in a dense forest, you want to be a big seed because you can grow bigger, higher, get more light above the trees. But if the forest becomes lighter, being a smaller seed that grows faster becomes advantageous. Now, this wasn't only noticed once. This was seen after the fall of the dinosaurs, as we saw the mammals grow from small into large mammals. And then about 50,000 years ago, when we saw the second extinction event, so the last one since the dinosaurs, we actually saw the megafauna drop off. And what we saw was that as the animals got bigger, so did the seeds, but only up to a point, the seeds begin to shrink again. So over those two episodes, the dinosaurs and these large mammoths and megafaunas, the animals themselves have actually engineered the ecosystems around them. It's incredible that they've actually managed to, just by being there, they've led to the evolution of seeds.
Yeah. There are exceptions, I suppose, to every rule, though, right? Like the avocado seed, for example, is enormous. There are some large seeds out there.
Absolutely.
Is this seen today? Are we shaping, as humans, are we shaping seed size?
Absolutely, Jonathan. That's the thing. I mean, it's kind of, there's a crazy link that what was left after the dinosaurs was this dense vegetation that came back after them. As soon as they left, the forest got denser, they filled up. And what came from that was bigger seeds, bigger fruits. And that actually fed our early ancestors. So that links us all the way back. Then came the megafauna, they fell away. And now we're the ones which are engineering the environments around us by cutting down forests, by shaping the way we want them. We have managed to do what these giant creatures could do just by the technology we have.
And so are the seeds now getting smaller or bigger?
At the moment, what we're seeing is that in time, the prediction is that the seeds will get smaller. Now, we're talking about, I guess, our timeline is such a small in evolutionary scale. But I mean, they're predicting into the future that almost the rules that were once there in nature because of our intervention have gone out the window.
Yeah.
That they will get smaller essentially, but because how we conduct agriculture, because how we, you know, design our towns, our cities, our forests, that nature is kind of losing control of it now.
Right. Very interesting. Our final story, Shelley, has to do with wet fingers.
Yes. So this is something that happens to all of us, but you mightn't have given it much thought. So you know those shriveled kind of raisin-like fingertips you get after a long bath or a swim?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever considered why this might happen to our fingers and our toes? You might think, like I did, that it's just from soaking in the water. But what actually happens is your brain is telling your blood vessels to tighten. So when we're in the water for a while, it lowers the salt in our skin, which then sends a signal to our brain, making certain blood vessels shrink. So what this does, essentially, is it pulls all that skin inward and creates those familiar little wrinkles.
Why?
Well, actually, it's really interesting. It's thought to be an evolutionary trick that helps us to grip things better when they're wet or slippery by creating texture. So if you think about picking up a wet stone or trying to clamber out of kind of a stony riverbed or even picking up or trying to wash a glass in the sink, those wrinkles might be acting like little tired threads that channel the water away and improve friction.
Huh.
Yeah. So a guy called Guy German, who's a biomedical engineer, innocently wrote a piece about this. And it was followed up by a question from a member of the public who just asked him, does this happen every time and does it happen the same way? And this completely stumped him. So in a beautiful example of citizen-driven research, he got to work on trying to answer this question. And he put in place a really nice, simple, but effective experiment. They had three people submerge their right hands in water for 30 minutes at 40 degrees Celsius. And immediately afterwards, they took photos of the finger pads and they repeated it at least 24 hours later. And what they noticed was that when they overlaid the images, the same fingers from both days revealed pairs of wrinkles that shared similar locations and shapes. And then they did further mathematical analysis, and it indicated that the corresponding wrinkles matched each other almost perfectly.
Right. So you're always wrinkle in the same way when you get wrinkly fingers.
So that was done, you know, within a kind of a 24-hour period. They don't know if this will happen on the length of scale of, let's say, 10 years or 50 years. They don't know whether blood vessel arrangements remain the same over a lifetime like fingerprints do. But if they do, and this is kind of opening the door for more exploration, they think that finger wrinkle patterns could help with biometric and forensic identification.
Right. God, it all comes back to security, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I know.
So I think every research is like, how do I get that DARPA money?
Yeah.
Really interesting. I never really thought about it. So next time I go for a soak, I'll be looking out for the patterns on my fingers. Thank you so much for joining us, Shelley and Owen. Now, Dr. Bob Breer, also known as Mr. Mummy, isn't just an expert in Egyptology. He's performed a full mummification using ancient techniques, the first person to ever do so, and I think still the only person to ever do so. He's joining us back on the program after many, many years. His interview on Future Proof about a decade ago has stuck in my mind ever since. We're so delighted to have him back to talk about Tutankhamun and how we might learn things from such an ancient tomb so many years later. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So last time I spoke with you, we were talking about your mummification techniques and your project there. Maybe you might tell me a little bit about that for those who haven't heard it, because it is an extraordinary thing that you did, and you learned so much from this process. So what were you trying to do with this mummification project?
Yeah, well, the project really started with me reviewing all the stuff that had been said about mummification in ancient Egypt. And a lot of it just didn't ring true. You know, I had been to medical school. I knew a little bit of anatomy. I knew some things about the human body. And it just didn't seem like it could happen that way, the way that all the Egyptologists were saying it. For example, every sixth grade kid can tell you that the brain comes out through the nose. Does it really? I mean, can you really get it out the way they said it did? You know, they said a little hook goes in and you pull it out a piece at a time. Would that work? There were other questions unanswered, like they used a certain salt called natron. It was a kind of naturally occurring compound, and they covered the body in this to dehydrate it. That's the crucial part of mummification, dehydrating the body. And I wondered, how much salt did you need? How much of this natron did you need? So there were loads and loads and loads of questions. I mean, I'll give you the one that worried me the most was they removed the internal organs through a small incision in the abdomen. Now, it's a small incision. It's only about two or three inches. And can you get a liver, which is the largest organ in the body? Can you get a liver out that little incision? So these are all kinds of questions I'm wondering about. So I figured the only way to answer the questions is to actually do a mummification. So I was given a cadaver by a medical school. You know, you apply for a cadaver for scientific purposes. And the idea was to do an actual ancient Egyptian mummification for the first time in 2,000 years.
And this, I mean, that's so cool. And this was done exactly the same way, as far as we could possibly know, as the Egyptians described it, the tools they used and so on. How did you piece together this process? Because obviously there must have been gaps in the knowledge, otherwise you wouldn't need to perform the mummification in the first place.
Yeah, there were tremendous gaps in the knowledge because the ancient Egyptians never wrote down how they did it. It was something they did for 2,000 years, and they did it a lot, but they never wrote down how they did it. So we had to do things like x-raying mummies to see what did the body look like, where was an incision made, things like that. And we're trying to just piece together as best we can from actual mummies, from the few records we have. For example, there's only one tomb that I know of that shows an embalmer's studio, and it shows guys working on a table, like a table, you know, with a mummy, wrapping it. They didn't show you taking out the organs or anything like that, but they're wrapping it. And there were certain things there that rang true. For example, the mummy isn't actually on a real table. What it's on is like two big blocks. So it's spanning the blocks like it's like the lintel of a pillar. And what the reason is, when they wrap it, you don't have to lift the body every time you're coming under the body to put the bandages. You just keep going around and around and around. So a lot of it rang true. So we were picking up these pieces from tombs, from mummies. And we even, you know, we knew what kind of tools they must have used because we had, you know, tools we found in archaeological excavations. So, for example, they didn't use anything like, you know, steel. They didn't have anything like that. They used stone tools, obsidian, which is volcanic glass, which is very sharp. And we had people who are flint makers and tool makers actually flake our tools for us for the mummification. So you're right. We tried to do it exactly like the Egyptians, but taking our clues from mummies and tombs and things like that.
How is the mummy doing now?
We like to say he's dead and well. We check on him every once in a while. Now, the question is, did we do it right? Will our mummy last? Will it persevere over 2,000 years, or is it a rotting corpse now? So every once in a while, every 4 or 5 years, we go and we take some biopsies. We take tissue samples to see if there's any sign of fungus or bacterial infection, things like that. And so far, he's doing fine. He's at room temperature, wrapped, and doing just fine.
What were the things that you learned from doing it? Because you'd read all of this stuff about, you know, the sort of tools they might use. You'd found artifacts, obviously, in tombs over the years that presumably were related to this. When you went about trying to remove the liver, for example, or get the brain out, or you know, all the things that they do, what were the things that you went, aha?
There were several aha moments. One was the brain, certainly the brain. According to all the accounts of Egyptologists, the way they did it was they put a little hooked instrument through the nose and into the cranial cavity. And then they would take it out. Imagine it like a little bent coat hanger. And they would go in through the nose, hook the brain, and take out the brain a piece at a time. You keep doing this, you know, it's sort of like on the shampoo bottle, repeat. You keep doing it over and over and over again until you get all the brain out, right? We tried it. Did not work. You cannot get a brain out that way because the brain isn't solid enough. It's a little too viscous. So anyway, we finally figured out how they did it. We had the coat hanger-like instrument. We put it through the nose, breaking through a bone that's called the cribriform plate, which is right behind your eyes, going into the cranial cavity. And then we took this hanger-like device and rotated it, kind of like a kitchen whisk, swirling it around, and we liquefied the brain. Then we turned the cadaver upside down and the brain ran out through the nose like a liquid, kind of looking like a strawberry milkshake. But what happens is then, and this makes sense, and this is, again, another aha moment. That's why we never find ancient Egyptian brains with the mummies. They didn't save it. You couldn't save it.
The other organs were saved. The liver, yeah. For example, the liver is preserved, and yet a tiny incision is made. How on earth did they get a full liver out?
Well, that's what I was wondering when I did this thing. Now, the liver is, as I said, the largest organ inside your body. Actually, the largest organ in your body is your skin. That's an organ, your skin. That's the largest. But the liver is, of course, the largest internal organ. Now, how do you get this thing out, as you ask? Well, the liver has three lobes. It has parts. They sort of are not separate, but they're connected. And what happened was when we started taking the liver out, I started pushing down on the abdomen where the liver is, moving it down. I, of course, first severed it from the rest of the organs. And I'm pushing it out, and one lobe kind of squeezes out, then another lobe squeezes out, and then the third lobe came. So it came together, and it was able to come because it deforms as it comes out through this little incision. So it's a little bit, just a little bit like a woman giving birth. It's kind of coming through a narrow passageway, but if you push and push and push, it'll deform a little, the cranium gets smaller, that kind of thing. So it came out.
How did you get the skill set? I mean, if there were any, serial killers in your area, I'd be wondering whether or not you'd gone to some class or something. How on earth did you get the skill set to figure out? I mean, forget about, knowing where to do the incision, because you would have got that from the cadaver, but then how to squeeze a liver out through that hole. Like, that sounds like it sounds like no one would do that for any reason in modern time.
But yeah, it's sort of on the job training. I mean, we're trying to figure out how to get this thing out, and that's the way we figured out how to do it. I had been to medical school. I had anatomy courses, so I know pretty much what a liver looks like and how it might deform. And I'm thinking, well, maybe this will work. And it did. And it did. But that was a hard part. Another thing we learned, by the way, which I think will surprise people, because the ancient world, by the ancient world, I mean the Greeks, they believed that the Egyptians were the most learned in anatomy because they did all these mummifications. But the answer is no. The Egyptians really didn't know much anatomy in spite of their mummifying. And the reason
How do you know that?
Well, I'll tell you how. Well, first of all, let me say why they wouldn't know a lot. When I did the mummification, I'm working through a 3-inch incision. So my hand is going into the incision and I'm feeling around, trying to feel the liver, where is the gallbladder, where is the spleen, where is this? And I'm trying to feel, and then I'm going to use my obsidian knife. I'm going to reach in. I'm going to cut the organ free. I'm going to pull it out, right? So I'm not really seeing the anatomical position of everything, right? I'm not really seeing it. Now, why do I say they didn't know much anatomy? First of all, as you mentioned just before, Jonathan, they saved the internal organs because they were resurrectionists. You wanted to get up and go again in the next world. So you had to save your internal organs and you'll be magically reassembled. So you'll be complete in the next world. Well, they had little jars for that, special jars called canopic jars, where they would put the organs. There were 4 of them. 4. But think about it. You have more than 4 internal organs.
Yep.
You might have a liver. You've got a kidney. Let's say liver, spleen, intestines, and you put them in the jar. But what about the other organs, right? For example, the kidneys. We don't see kidneys in these canopic jars. And I'll tell you why. They didn't know they existed.
Hmm.
If you reach into your abdominal cavity and you feel around, you've taken out the liver, you've taken out the stomach, you've taken out the intestines, and you start feeling around, now you say, I got it. It's all empty. It's all smooth. But you're wrong. Behind a thick membrane, which is called a peritoneum, is the kidneys. They are protected by a thick membrane. So when the embalmer stuck his hand in, he's feeling around. He doesn't even know there are kidneys. So
Why is that? Because presumably they would have seen was it a belief in Egypt that you couldn't desecrate a corpse so that they didn't? I mean, obviously, modern surgery has benefited hugely from people opening up corpses and having a look inside. Did Egyptians not do that?
That's right. You're absolutely right. You couldn't desecrate a corpse in ancient Egypt because you wanted to resurrect and be complete. So they didn't do sort of anatomy lessons. They didn't do autopsies. They didn't do any of that. So that they were really quite ignorant of anatomy. It was one of the things I found. I mean, they just really didn't know what they were doing in a lot of ways.
What about the heart?
The heart is special. This is, again, here's an example of they didn't know anatomy. They believed that you thought with your heart, not the brain. They didn't fully understand the function of the brain. So, for example, they believed that when you went to the next world, you're going to have a day of judgment, and your heart, your physical heart, would be weighed against the feather of truth to see if you were a truthful person and if you could go to the next world. So it's the heart that's important to them. They believe that you thought with your heart. Now, we have a holdover from this. I mean, think about it. Valentine's Day. What do you send on Valentine's Day? Little chocolate hearts, right? We should be sending little chocolate brains, right? But the idea is that it's not counterintuitive to think that the heart is where you think. When you get excited, it's your heart that beats quickly. And that's why we say things like, be still my foolish heart. You know, we don't say, be still my foolish brain. So they didn't know the function of the brain even. And so they left the heart inside the body. That was the one organ they left inside the body so that on the day of judgment, you'd be able to think and say the right words to be resurrected. So you had to have your heart with you.
In these jars, did you find anything you couldn't identify? Like this, and I'm so sorry I didn't give a proper warning at the top of the program, but this liquefied brain, a strawberry milkshake, was that stored in a jar somewhere?
Never seen one, my friend. I think they just...
Why is that?
It's the kind of thing that they... First of all, they didn't realize the function of the brain.
Yeah.
The other is that it comes out like a milkshake. You know, it's not the kind of thing you save. It's not a distinct organ. It doesn't seem like anything that's crucial. It's like body fluids, maybe, or something like that. But they just threw it out in the same way, you know, you wouldn't save the blood or whatever.
And so then the actual preservation. So you take those things out because they're liquid and they're gonna rot. And you're left with, I mean, you're not left with a skeleton. So how do you preserve the internal parts that are moist and, wet and the external part? And if the heart's there, then like, how do you preserve a body in that way?
Yeah. Well, it's a very, very good question. It's crucial. Now, the Egyptians did know that the really crucial thing to preserve a body is to dehydrate it. No moisture in the body. If you don't have moisture in a body, bacteria will not act on the tissue. Bacteria need moisture, water to act. So for example, when you have these cereals with like a dried blueberry in it, the reason you can have dried blueberries and they won't rot, they won't mold, is they're dehydrated.
Yeah.
And it's really, in a sense, a mummy of a blueberry, right? And it's the same with the human body. And I think they learned this by their earlier burials. In the very earliest times of Egyptian civilization, they buried their dead in the sand.
Right.
And the sand, of course, dries things out quickly before it can decay. So then what happens is you bury a body, and then maybe 100 years later, some kind of storm comes up and the sand is blown away and there's a body, but it's a recognizable human being because it's been dehydrated. Mm. So in a way, the desert was the first embalmer. And they realized from this that you have to dehydrate the body. So they take out the organs and they cover the body with a salt. I mean, as everybody knows, salt dehydrates things.
So internally and externally, they cover it in salt.
Yeah, they had little packets. They would like what we call little sachets, little linen packets that they put salt in, and they would put these little packets inside the body cavity after they've evacuated it. We did that too. We had 22 packets of natron that we put in. And one of the things we learned, we were wondering how much water or body fluids do the packets absorb? Well, the answer is they doubled their weight in the mummification process. So in other words, we put in 22 pounds of natron in the abdominal cavity, and it came out 40 pounds. So it just about took out its own weight in moisture. So it was very effective. And then they also covered the entire body with natron.
You're listening to Future Proof with me, Jonathan McRae. I'm speaking to Bob Breyer. He is also known as Mr. Mummy. He's been talking about the incredible process of mummification by the Egyptians. In a few minutes' time, we'll be talking about King Tut and what we can learn from an ancient tomb so many thousands of years later. Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking to Dr. Bob Breyer, also known as Mr. Mummy, about his incredible work studying the mummification processes of Egyptians. And now we're going to talk about King Tut, Tutankhamun's tomb, and what we can learn from it so many years later. So, Bob, just remind us, for those who can't remember that far back to our school days, who was Tutankhamun, and when did we learn that this tomb existed?
Well, Tut was a minor king in terms of Egyptian history. He became pharaoh when he was only 10 years old. His father died. He was the last male. So he's a young pharaoh. But he dies at the age of about 18 or 19 as a teenager. And he's buried rather hastily in a small tomb in the Valley of the Kings. So he was a minor pharaoh by Egyptian standards. But in 1922, Howard Carter discovered his tomb. And the thing that makes Tut so important to us now is that it's the only tomb ever found in the Valley of the Kings that was intact. So Tut had all his gold, his coffins, everything. He took it with him. You know, the Egyptians were resurrectionists. They believe you would get up and go again in the next world. So they packed their tombs with everything they thought they would need. So Tut brought four chariots with him. He had all his clothes. He had a dozen sandals, pairs of sandals. He had everything. So that's why the tomb is so famous. It was chock-a-block with all kinds of treasures.
Why is it the only one that is so intact? What happened to the other tombs?
Well, the other tombs were robbed over the thousands of years. Even in ancient times, in Egyptian times, robbers knew that there were fabulous treasures buried with the kings. So at night, they would go into the Valley of the Kings when there were lawless times. There wasn't so many police, things like that. And they would break into the tombs and steal anything of value. So up until 1922, in the Valley of the Kings, we had 62 tombs, but only Tutankhamun's was found intact. All the others had been robbed.
And why his?
Well, his was sort of spared from being robbed because it was near another tomb. Now, Tut's buried, and a later pharaoh, Ramses VI, has his tomb very close to Tut's. And what happens is when the workmen are constructing that tomb, when they're hollowing out the mountain to make a tomb, they take all the limestone chips, all the debris, and dump it on Tut's tomb. So Tut's tomb disappears under all this debris, all these limestone chips, and nobody knows it's there. So For 2,000 years, nobody knew Tut's tomb was there. And who's going to move all these limestone chips when it doesn't look promising? It just looks like debris. So finally, Howard Carter came along and said, we are going to clear the tomb right down to the valley, down to bedrock, and find the tomb of this missing pharaoh. There were a couple of references to him in records, and they were searching for it and searching for it. And then he found it right under the debris.
Unbelievable. And what a find, because it's a snapshot of that time that is as intact as possible. So tell us about the stuff that we knew 20 years ago, and then you might tell us about what new research and scientific techniques might have told us since. So what is the stuff that's been in all our school books? What do we know about King Tut?
Yeah, well, the stuff that we know, of course, we know all about the discovery of the tomb, Howard Carter searching for it. And then we know a bit about the excavation, how Carter was interested in, you know, taking careful records, everything's photographs. We learn how an excavation is done and all that. And then, of course, all the treasures are moved to Cairo, which is about 500 miles north, and placed in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, where they are seen today, they were seen by tourists. Now, so everybody knows about the treasures. But recently I did a book. I did a book, this thing called Tutankhamun and the Tomb That Changed the World. I wanted to show people that it's not just the treasures that are found, put in the museum, and that's the end of the story. There's more to it than that. Since the discovery, it took 10 years to empty the tomb. There were so many artifacts that had to be preserved and before you could move them. You know, you're dealing with 2,000-year-old pieces of wood. You have to first coat them in wax so you can move them. They don't fall apart. So it took 10 years to clear the tomb and get everything to Cairo and on display. Now, many people think, well, okay, that's the end of the story. You got it on display. We got the treasures of King Tut. That's it. But no, since, say, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, people have started doing scientific research on the objects to see what we can learn about Tutankhamun, right? Including the mummy. We've learned a lot about Tutankhamun as a person also. So there are specialists who work on different things. So just for example, there's one guy who wrote a book just on the leather objects in Tutankhamun's tomb. Now that includes his sandals, right? He had leather sandals like we do. But also there was a suit of armor, a leather suit of armor inside the tomb. And one of the things they discovered is that it had been worn. In other words, when you examine it carefully, you might be able to see sweat stains, things like that. You might be able to see places where the leather's worn, right? So the fact that Tutankhamun wore this leather suit of armor, he may have been a warrior. You know, when he was 18, he may have led the army into battle. So we learned things like that. Also, you may have heard that some people thought that Tutankhamun had a club foot, that he walked on the side of his foot. It's not true. It's not true. And one of the things we learned is from the sandals, if he really had a club foot, the sandals would have been worn, you know, not symmetrically. So he was, as far as we can tell, he was a healthy, fairly healthy young man. So we're learning lots and lots about Tutankhamun by these scientific researchers. And that's what I did in my book. I wanted to show people the research that's going on. I mean, for example, one of the coolest thing I think is really cool, is Tutankhamun was buried with a dagger with an iron blade, right? It's a beautiful dagger, rock crystal handle. and it has an iron blade. Now, the interesting thing is that there was no iron in Egypt then, right? Where did the iron come from? And the answer is it came from outer space. They found the iron, right, had come from a meteorite. And I think that's really cool that there are a couple objects in Tutankhamun that come from outer space.
I'm sorry, the iron from Tutankhamun's blade came from a meteorite that landed somewhere in Egypt.
And then what they do is iron meteorites are basically iron. And what they do is they pound it with hammers to form it into whatever you want. You heat it, you pound it, and they made a blade out of this meteorite. So I think it's kind of cool that at least we know it came from outer space. And everybody's wondering, where'd they get iron? But then you can do tests and you can show that it came from a meteorite. So
that's been proven, actually. That's not a theory. That's been proven from a meteorite.
There is no doubt about it. It came from a meteorite. Now, the only question we have is, did the meteorite land in Egypt, or was perhaps the dagger a gift from a foreign country that had found a meteorite? So right. we're not sure. Now, just recently, with satellite photography, we found a huge meteoritic crater in the Egyptian desert. Very remote spot. Very, very, very remote spot. But you can see this big crater. And did Tut's iron come from that crater, from a meteorite, right? So scientists, geologists, set out for 4 days to reach this crater, going across the desert. No roads. You know, you're going by compass, and that's it. No roads. And they found the crater. They took samples of the meteorite back. There were still loads of fragments of this meteorite that had struck the Earth. They brought it back to Cairo. They analyzed them and showed that that meteorite is not the one the Tut's dagger came from. It's a different pattern of stress marks in the iron. So, nope, it didn't come from there. So maybe it came from a foreign meteorite.
Wow. Well, what about genetics? Can we get any genetic information from Tut? Or is that all degraded long ago?
Samples of DNA have been taken from King Tut. There's an Egyptian DNA laboratory in Cairo that worked on it. And what we're trying to see is how good is the DNA. Now, the problem with ancient DNA is that it's very, very difficult to get good samples run in a laboratory. So what we do in the ancient DNA, whenever we do it, is we confirm it with another laboratory. If you get a result and say, this shows Tut's sister was so-and-so, then we have to confirm it with another outside laboratory. Our problem is that, and I mentioned this in the book, is that the Egyptians never let any DNA samples out of Egypt. So it hasn't been confirmed. So even though they think they've got results, we really can't trust them yet till another laboratory checks it out. So all the DNA stuff about Tut really isn't confirmed. So we're waiting.
Right. And I guess there's probably a little bit of territorialness that happens when you have such a prized scientific specimen, a little bit of international tension when, you know, the scientific community want this or they might want access to that. Is that tricky?
Yeah, you're right. There's a little bit of competition. The Egyptians want to do it themselves. We don't need the foreigners sometimes. So it's a little tricky. It is. I mean, in general, it's good to work with them, but sometimes there are problems.
What about mass spectroscopy, using other sorts of tools, like the really cutting edge stuff that we have? Has that yielded any new information about King Tut?
The answer is yes. For example, we've done CAT scans of the Tut's mummy, which is very, very helpful. And it helps tell us about his health, his bone density, things like that. What was his nutrition like? So things like, you know, that CAT scan stuff is good. One of the most high-tech things we've ever done is a kind of X-ray of the Great Pyramid of Giza using cosmic rays that come from outer space. And they put detectors of muons, which is one of the cosmic rays, at the bottom of the pyramid in a chamber all the way at the bottom. And they see as the muons come through the pyramid, we get high density, low density. So we can see if there are any secret passageways or hidden places inside the Great Pyramid. And in the last year or so, we found a couple of spots that are voids, they're called. They're empty spaces inside the pyramid. They don't seem to have treasure or anything like that, but they do seem to have been used for maybe building purposes or architectural reasons. But there are empty spaces within the pyramid that have been discovered by this new technique using muon technology.
Very cool. Dr. Bob Breyer, a.k.a. Mr. Mummy, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. If you've ever been to Egypt and seen King Tut's tomb or visited any of these places. Love to hear your reaction to that and your stories, please. You can email us science@newstalk.com. Some of your comments from last week's programme. If you remember, we were talking about penguin poop and the fact that penguin poop actually causes cloud formation because of the amount of ammonia that then interacts with the air and creates a greater cloud formation, which in turn stops the ice from melting. So all of these systems are quite complex, but actually penguin poop has a significant effect on cloud formation and therefore the retention of ice at Antarctica. That's what we learned last week. And it turns out that penguin poop is pink. We had a text in from someone, Jamie, who says, why is penguin poop pink? Did I miss something? I thought Jess mentioned it in passing, but it's because of the krill, the crustaceans that penguins eat. They're pink, and so the pigment comes through in their poop. Fee says, we were talking about the Earth's core last week and something completely different. And Fee says, will more and more precious metals continue to leak out of the Earth's core then? And we were talking about the fact that the Earth's core appears to be leaking a little bit. And so we see this in volcano sites where we get material and rare earth elements that are coming up through the mantle and the crust and out through volcanic sites. Fee's wondering, will more and more precious metals continue to leak out? I mean, I guess they will. It's not a static process. And we heard last week that our Earth is a very dynamic, it's a very living, dynamic planet, which is why it's so suitable for life. So absolutely, Fee, this is a dynamic process and it will continue, I presume, until the Earth goes cold, which is set to happen, but not in our time, our lifetime. So we don't need to worry too much about it. That is it from us on this week's programme. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. In the meantime,
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.